The following program from the North Carolina Reading Service is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. It's the Indie Week, and it's read today by John Federson. This weekly issue is dated May the 18th of 2022. And today's musicians, for today only, I believe, the duet of Balthazar and Ethel. We thank them for our theme music. And folks, since this is so close to last Tuesday's election, or primary and election, the Indie Week has got on its website the unofficial election results for most of the contests. And I'll run down that list right now at this point. For the United States House and Senate, the primary winners, Sherry Beasley, Democrat, and Ted Budd, Republican. For District 4, the House, Valerie Fouché for Democrat, and Courtney Giles for Republican. District 13 House, Wiley Nickel wins the Democratic primary, and Bo Hines, the Republican. Now, District 13 for the NC House and Senate, the Senate, District 13, Democrat Lisa Grafstein and Republican David Bankert will square off in the general. And District 18 for the Senate, E.C. Sykes is Republican primary and will run unopposed unless write-ins come in. The same for Larry Coleman, Republican, Senate District 22. Senate District 23, Democratic primary Greg Meyer will meet Landon Woods, the Republican. And in the House District 33, Democrat primary Rosa Gill is unopposed right now. Same with Ashley Seschel for District 34, Democrat. In District 35, Republican Fred Von Kannen is unopposed. There was no Democratic winner in the primary. And Democratic primary Christine Kelly wins House District 37 primary. And District 40 for the House, Joe John, Democrat primary. And Renee Price, Democrat primary. House District 50, Alan Buonsi, District 56, Democrat for the House. And District 66, Sarah Crawford, Democrat for the House. These are all winners of the primary elections and will face most of the last ones will not face a Republican opponent, I believe. In Durham County, Satana DeBerry is elected, I guess, district attorney, and Clarence Burkhead, sheriff, Amina Thompson, clerk of court. The Board of Education, there are five winners are there. Emily Chavez, District 1, Bettina Umstead, District 2, Matt Sears, District 3, Natalie Beyer, District 4, and District B, Millicent Rogers. For NC District Court 14, two winners, Dave Hall and Kevin E. Jones. And Wake County, District Attorney winner, Lauren Freeman. There will be a runoff between Riley Rowe and Gerald Baker for the Senate, for the Sheriff's Office, the main election. This was a primary. And either of those folks will face Donnie Harrison, the Republican, in the fall election. Board of Commissioners, District 1, Donald Meal wins, and Cheryl Stallings in District 3. In the Cary Town Council, three names winners, Jennifer Robinson, Renee Miller, and at-large Carissa Johnson. Orange County, District Attorney Jeff Neiman, and four seats in the Board of Education for Orange County, Andre Richmond, Ann Purcell, Will Atherton, and Sarah Smiley. Register of Deeds in Orange County, Mark Chilton, and in the Carrboro Town Council, Eleazar Posada. For the Judiciary, the Supreme Court, Seat 5, this is a Republican primary. In fact, all these three are Republican primaries. Trey Allen, and the Court of Appeals, Seat 9, Donna Stroud. Finally, the Court of Appeals, Seat 11, Michael Stading. All of those three names are the Republican primary winners. And if there may be more that I haven't got, that's not printed, at least in the Indy Week, and we'll get those to you next time. We'll move now to the print edition of Indie Week and news from Raleigh. Jasmine Gallup writes, Green Vision. About a quarter mile south of the North Carolina Museum of Art's main building, a muddy creek winds its way through a tangled forest. From a paved path, Rachel Woods, the director of the museum's park operations, points to a pool of dark water surrounded by fallen branches and river rocks. That's an exit to a culvert running underneath the Reedy Creek Trail. She says, I kind of grew up in streams like that, playing in water. It's such an asset for our park that's not really accessible right now because it's so eroded. The banks are so incised. Even to my untrained eye, it's clear this creek's not supposed to look like this. The water stands at the bottom of a 2-foot trench, a deep channel floodwaters have carved. The creek banks are ragged and torn, exposing tree roots that dangle helplessly from the dirt. It's like a gash in the skin of the earth. This unnamed creek is the focus of a multi-year project to restore the museum's 164-acre park, repairing damage done to the land in past years, and preparing the landscape for the future stresses of climate change. The 200-page Museum Park Vision Plans also outlines how landscape architects will make the park self-sustainable, cutting down on the maintenance needed for things like trail repairs. Woods says a landscape to be sustainable cannot require a lot of funding and labor over time. It's just not maintainable. We're looking at restoring the site to what it would have been. I won't see it in my lifetime, but I know what it's going to be over the long term. At different times in history, the museum parkland was used as a prison farm, military training camp, and part of NC State University's veterinary school. Crop growing and cattle grazing left the land stripped of its natural grasses. Later, trampling by boots and tanks kept plants from taking deep root. The grasses that have taken hold in the park's upper meadow today simply don't have deep enough roots, says Martha Eberle, a landscape architect with Andropogon Associates, one of the companies involved in creating this park vision plan. Rains often run straight off the topsoil into the park below, washing sediment downhill, worsening water quality, and eroding areas downstream. Eberle says it's not all that different than having an impervious surface like concrete or pavement. And she continues, part of the plan to restore the park includes planting warm season grasses like wild rye and flowers like sunflowers and cornflowers in those upper meadows. Those native plants have deep roots. She says they're capturing more of that stormwater and allowing it to filter back down into the water table. Then that's setting off all these relationships in the soil that's allowing for more things to grow. More plants means more carbon being stored in the actual plants, but also in the roots and in the soil. The Park Vision Plan also calls for expanding and protecting the park's existing wetlands and planting additional water species in the area that will help retain stormwater. Some paths will be rerouted to slope more gently down the hill and avoid biologically diverse areas. Woods points to a clutch of river oats next to a wooden bridge that arcs over House Creek. Just looking, I can tell water stands here. Thus, plant material is telling me this area wants to be wetland. The infrastructure, that's the bridge, is in conflict with what the stream is trying to do. Expanding wetlands and stormwater detention is one of the most important parts of the plan. As climate change worsens, North Carolina has started seeing stronger and more frequent storms that lead to flooding of rivers, roads, and highways. Eberle says, one of the main reasons we were brought in for the art museum project is that the landscape there is really feeling the effects of climate change. Development around the museum and in Raleigh is putting additional strain on the landscape, she goes on. There's a lot more impervious surfaces surrounding that museum. So that's bringing faster and higher volumes of stormwater in. Just being out there on any day, you can see the impacts it's having. Improvements to the museum park will help mitigate flooding in House Creek and the Crabtree area, according to Woods, who explains, our whole site is falling toward downtown. Blue Ridge Road is like the ridge line. So we're looking at how to, along the way, do little rain gardens or wetlands that will naturally let that water immerse into the ground and replenish the water table. At the heart of the project is the stream restoration, which involves moving dirt, removing fallen and dead trees, and raising the level of the stream channel that's been eroded over time. Even there, however, the team plans to work sustainably, ensuring nothing goes to waste. Eberle says, any trees that have to be taken out or any trees that are already dead, we'll repurpose those as structures in the stream restoration, or even milling up lumber for benches or signage. Any piece of a tree you can't use, you build up these mounds of vegetation and let them decompose over time in places that really need targeted soil building. One of the long-term goals of the park project is to restore the park's natural habitats, removing invasive species and cultivating native plants. Woods says that in turn will help pull more carbon out of the air. A lot of these plants that were native to the Piedmont region actually do a lot of carbon fixing. They pull a lot of carbon out of the atmosphere and kind of store it in the ground. Almost every aspect of the plan helps increase the park's potential for storing and sequestering carbon. The stream restoration will create new wetland areas where plants can grow. The planting of native grasses will improve the park's soil quality and reduce the need for irrigation and maintenance, which costs energy. The plan will ultimately add more than 12 acres of forest to the park and install small trees and shrubs along the forest edge, adding to the green space and reducing the amount of turf. Plans include expansion of the existing walnut tree grove and installation of a bald cypress grove. The process of restoring the park's habitats will be a long one, however. Woods has already organized several community service days to take out invasive plants, but it's an ongoing battle, she says. Ultimately, the work is worth it. After volunteers took out much of the park's privet, an invasive plant that prevents even tree seedlings from growing, they saw some native species naturally return to the park. Woods says, we saw lots of species of fern, even several species of orchids coming up, all because they now have some room to grow. It's thrilling, to be honest. It's a lot of manual labor to do this work, so when you see those results of things we've planted, it's just great to see the things you plant grow and have that reward of, this is beautiful now. Restoration of these natural habitats will hopefully bring native wildlife back into the park, says Woods. It'll take time, years, but the park should eventually be a biodiverse haven for songbirds, owls, ducks, otters, turtles, salamanders, and even beavers. As new construction springs up around the museum and across the triangle, Eberle is hoping that the park's environmentally friendly design will be an inspiration to developers, showing them how to work with the land. She says, it really comes down to what we call a regenerative design. You're not just coming in and plopping down a building. You're coming in and trying to understand the systems and networks that are in place within that site, the ecological networks of water and soil and plants and animals. It's really about knitting those systems back together. The Southeast has been a little slow to start excuse me, to start using these concepts of environmentally friendly design, says Eberle. But as hurricanes sweep in, heat islands increase in temperature and more people pour into Raleigh, they offer a promising solution to some of the area's biggest problems. Eberle says, I do think there's a lot of room for improvement. Not every developer has a forest on their site they can protect, but there are principles of regenerative design you can bring into any development or any property. Meanwhile, museum staff plan to use the project to help educate museum and park visitors about nature. Hopefully, people will leave with a better understanding of the environment and how they can make some changes in their own backyard, says Woods. Expanded hands-on educational programs for everyone from elementary schoolers to ecology students at NC State are on the horizon. The coronavirus pandemic has given many North Carolinians a greater appreciation for green spaces, says Woods. Starting in 2019, the museum park saw an explosion of visitors, a 23% increase in the number of visitors in 2021 over the previous year. In 2020, the park was just shy of 1 million visitors. Woods says having that kind of space for people to have serenity is important. That's what we heard from a lot of people, that they came to the park and they found peace and rejuvenation. And she says, in an urban setting like Raleigh, it's important for people, especially children, to get out into nature. Nature should be experienced, she says. It shouldn't just be the sort of textbook image or an elusive idea. It should be engaged with. Eberle, who also works on increasing social engagement with green spaces, agrees. One concept her company uses in design is biophilia, the innate instinct to connect with nature, saying, it's the concept that people need to experience nature in their everyday life in order to be the healthiest people we can be. So how do we bring that into the hard urban environment? The overall goal of the project, she says, is to heal the park's natural systems, create a more unified campus for the museum, and allow visitors to immerse themselves more deeply in nature. She says, this is such a beloved landscape in Raleigh. I think the museum is really interested in making sure that legacy is continued. You can see the park is being threatened right now. You can see how the streams are suffering. I think museum staff saw that and realized if they didn't do something, they were going to lose this gem they have. And finally, at the end of this article, a free museum exhibit, to be rather than to seem, which happens to be the state's motto, explores the history of the museum park and the new environmental vision plan designed by Andrew Pogon Associates, Biohabitats, and W.K. Dixon. Work on the park, starting with a stream restoration, is expected to begin next year. All right, next, Lena Geller pens this article from Durham. It's titled Heart of Service. Last Thursday, on her first morning as a Durham City Council member, Dr. Monique Holsey-Hyman pushed back her own travel plans to make time for a constituent. She was supposed to leave for New York at noon. She'd been asked to speak at one of Columbia University's commencement ceremonies that weekend and still needed to figure out what she was going to stay, but the constituent was asking for her help. And Holsey-Hyman is not one to decline a request for assistance. She could write her speech in the car, she decided. If you are reading this, you're experiencing the result of that first act of service, writes Lena Geller. The constituent was me, and the request was for an interview. Holsey-Hyman was sworn in last Wednesday. The previous week, she was appointed to finish the term of former council member Charlie Reese, who resigned in March to move to Paris with his family. 21 people applied to fill the at-large seat, and the council chose four exceptionally strong finalists: Nate Baker, an urban planner, Shaniqua Nicole Diggs, an NC Central University Assistant Professor of Public Administration, Henry McCoy, Jr., an NCCU Business Professor, and Holsey Hyman, a professor of social work who teaches courses at NC Central and Walden University, and invited them for lengthy interviews. After 40 Durham residents spoke in support of their favored candidates at a public comment session, the council selected Holsey Hyman in a unanimous vote. During my conversation with Holsey Hyman, she comes across as she did during her interview with the council: confident, vulnerable, and for the people. She's polished in appearance, curled hair, manicured nails, pearl necklace, and earrings, but speaks with the air of a revolutionary, waving her hands and dropping one-liners in a thick New York accent. "When you cut us, our blood is red like yours," she told the council during her interview. She answers most of questions with a story. When I ask about the topic of her Columbia speech, for example, she first tells me about the student, Trina Nurse, who landed her the gig. Before Nurse went to college, she was living in a shelter, cooking on a hot plate with one on her hip and one in the carriage, Holsey Hyman tells me. When Nurse got a scholarship to Columbia, Holsey Hyman, who works as an external advisor for the university, took her on as a mentee. Now, Nurse is graduating with a master's degree in social work. She always says I'm her inspiration, and I'm like, "No, you're my hero," says Holsey Hyman. 30 years ago, like Nurse, Holsey Hyman graduated from Columbia as a first-generation student with a master's in social work. Her speech will be directed towards 2022 graduates who are the first in their families to complete a degree, she says, applauding their accomplishments while stressing that being a first-gen person doesn't define who you are. She was born and raised in the South Bronx. When she was 3 years old, her parents divorced and her mother turned to public assistance programs to support her family. She says, "I'm very humbled to say that I have humble beginnings. My mother still remembers the first man who gave her a check." Despite having limited resources, Holsey Hyman's mother always found activities for her four daughters. She would take them to the South Street Seaport to see free puppet shows, guide them through museums, and most often bring them along to meetings for public bodies like the Tenant Board, Community Board, the PTA, the Borough Council, and the City Council. Holsey Hyman says, "That's where I learned the importance of servant leadership and giving back. My mother always said, 'I'm going to fight for what's right.'" When she watched her mother speak in front of the City Council, she says, it made her feel particularly empowered. During junior high, Holsey Hyman was placed in a program for gifted students called SP, Special Progress, which accelerated her schooling and allowed her to graduate high school at age 16. Before and after her stint at Columbia, she completed a bachelor's degree in human services and sociology at the University of New York in Binghamton and a doctorate of education at Walden University. She performed the bulk of her field work in New York. While she was still in school, she interned at Rikers Island, conducting needs assessment for incarcerated women who were separated from their children. Upon graduating, she worked her way up the ranks of the Child Welfare Administration before becoming the Director of Intensive Care Management at Steinway Child and Family Services, a mental health organization in Queens. The start of her career coincided with the beginning of the crack cocaine epidemic, and much of her work became centered around securing housing and facilitating mental health services for children with family members suffering from substance use disorder. At Steinway, she spearheaded the creation of the first case management program in the South Bronx, transforming a bodega into a community center that supported children who had Axis 1 disorders, that's anxiety, depression, ADD, drug addiction, as well as histories with child welfare. To launch the program, she secured funding from state and city offices of mental health and knocked on residents' doors to get their buy-in. By leading this project, as well as a subsequent expanded program that offered 24-hour services for mental and physical health, housing, and case management, Jose Hymens said she learned what it takes to get resources in a community. In 2006, after one of her sisters died of breast cancer, Jose Hymens was seeking a change in both scenery and routine. She'd always wanted to become an educator, and she was drawn to Durham's vibrancy, diversity, and arts scene. She says, "I've seen more Broadway plays here than I've seen in New York." After landing a job as an assistant professor of social work at Shaw University, she bought a house near South Point Mall and put down roots in the Bull City. During her 12 years at Shaw and now at NC Central, Jose Hymens has gone to great lengths to invest in her students, both inside and outside the classroom. She says, "If they're not in my class, I'm knocking on their door. We need you to stay." Though her tactics have earned her a reputation for being a little crazy, she says, they've paid off. She's won over 25 awards and honors for her achievements as an educator. And at the public comments session for the at-large council seat, several of Jose Hymens' former students took the podium to describe how she has changed their lives. One student, Allison Morrow, said she was overwhelmed with trepidation when she started the Master of Social Work program at Central. She had recently entered recovery from substance use disorder and was struggling to see her own self-worth. She says, "I was full of shame and guilt and had lost in large part the ability to believe in myself. Broken and afraid, I was fortunate to take one of Professor Hymens' courses my first semester. She immediately began to pour hope and life back into me." Through Jose Hymens' support, Moreau became empowered to use her experiences to help others and is now employed as a social worker at an alcohol and drug center. She said, "She's a visionary with a heart of service. She believes in the future of this city and sees its youth as those who hold the key to its success." 4 days after speaking at the public comment session, Morrow graduated from NCCU with a master's in social work. Beyond her professional work, Jose Hymens' heart of service is evident in her civic engagement experience. She's held positions on the Durham Mental Health Board and a number of improvement teams for local public schools, and currently serves on Durham's Citizen Advisory Council and Board of Commissioners Social Service Board. She says, "When people say to me, 'What do you do for fun?' I'm like, 'I'm on the DSS board,'" she says, laughing. "But really, I get something out of helping people. That's what makes me tick." And that's why she applied to join the council, she says. She loves to help people, and she's good at it. Jose Hymens' top priorities for Durham are affordable housing, youth programming, and crime reduction. Her husband, stepfather, and younger sister are all current or retired police officers. And she says this proximity, paired with her social work experience, has helped her to gauge the resources and initiatives needed to keep residents safe. She's a strong proponent of community policing and believes law enforcement departments should have social workers on staff to deal with mental health and domestic violence that officers are not trained to handle. She also wants to increase resources for formerly incarcerated people who are reentering the community. During her interview with the council, Jose Hymens voiced support for ShotSpotter. That's a gunfire detection alert technology that instantly notifies police of the location where a shot has been fired. Council members recently voted to bring ShotSpotter to Durham as a pilot program, though the vote was divided. 3 dissenting council members shared deep concerns with how the technology has been deployed in other cities, citing an incident in Chicago where police shot and killed a 13-year-old boy after responding to a ShotSpotter alert. Olsi Hyman told me that she needs to do more research on the technology to assess how it might impact Durham, but thinks it's amazing that it can track gunfire with such precision. She says, I've lived in the projects. It's a culture. You're not going to get people to tell you. That's where the shot came from. It would definitely help us to know where things are happening. Councilman Leonardo Williams says the council couldn't have gone wrong with any of the four finalists. He says he hopes that the other three candidates will run in the next election, especially Baker, whom he describes as a wealth of knowledge. But they felt that Holsey Hyman's set of skills would best augment the council's existing expertise. Last winter, when Durham's Braswell apartments were sold to new owners and its tenants were given just 30 days to relocate, Williams says the council was unable to support the tenants who asked them for assistance. The county takes care of social services, Williams says, so all we could say was, oh, well, go to the county. That didn't sit right with me. The council wasn't just in need of a social services expert, Williams says. We were also missing a bit of tenacity. When he listened to Murrow speak about Holsey Hyman's role in propelling her to success, William knew that this candidate had the tenacity he'd been looking for. And he says, we tend to be a bit transactional. But who's going to take the resources that we pull together and make them transformative? That's what we were seeking. Alrighty. Now, Hannah Kaufman has written Executive Update. Every year, once a year, the world comes together to celebrate the one thing that allows us to live and breathe, our planet. Last month, Earth Day arrived with its usual outpour of love. People planted trees. Social media overflowed with lightly filtered photos of families posing in front of landmarks and sunsets. And while it is a day for appreciating the beauty of our oceans, forests, mountains, and deserts, Earth Day is also one for political action and environmental accountability. The year 2020 marked 50 years since Earth Day's founding. By the time we reach 100 years, however, scientists believe that the impacts of climate change and increased natural disasters may transform this annual day of appreciation into a cry for help. Governor Roy Cooper signed a new executive order in early January to address these effects of climate change in North Carolina, setting statewide goals to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and encourage green transportation. Executive Order 246 is the most recent of a series of orders passed over the last few years. EO 246, or North Carolina's Transformation to a Clean, Equitable Economy, contains ambitious goals. 50% reduction of statewide greenhouse gas emissions from 2005 levels by 2030, and a net zero carbon emissions no later than 2050. Now, 4 months since the order's release, it's important to revisit its goals and evaluate the state's progress during a climate crisis that calls for immediate action, says Steve Calland, who serves on an advisory committee for EO 246, Clean Transportation Plan. He says, all of these kinds of changes take time, and it has probably not been long enough for most of this to actually register yet. The flip side is the clock is ticking, and we've got a lot of ground to cover, both to meet the goals in the executive order and to meet the goals necessary to avoid greater than 2-degree temperature increase because of climate change. One of the order's main provisions is the NC Clean Transportation Plan, which gives the Department of Transportation, DOT, 15 months to create a viable plan for decarbonizing the transport sector, reducing vehicle miles traveled, and increasing the availability of zero-emission vehicles so that by 2030, 50% of vehicles sold are zero-emission. In addition to this provision is a required greenhouse gas inventory to be updated every 2 years. A decarbonization pathways analysis that will identify potential paths to reduce emissions and the appointment of a mandatory environmental justice lead within every cabinet agency. This order expands on the goals of past executive orders. In North Carolina, says Dion Delegati, the state's clean energy director who helped create this clean energy plan. And she says, it builds on some of the efforts that date back to 2018, when Executive Order 80 started us on this course. This increases those goals to meet and keep up with the science. It increases the economy-wide target and really tries to take a look at where we are and what we've been successful in and where there are still gaps. Executive Order 80 contains a clean energy plan that encourages the use of clean energy resources like solar power and wind to create a resilient electric grid, and a North Carolina zero-emission vehicle plan with a goal of 80,000 ZEVs by 2025, says Delegati. And Brian Powell, Director of Communications at NC Conservation Network, has no doubt that the state will meet the ZEV goal, but this new executive order ups that target significantly. And he says, the executive order sets a goal of 1.25 million registered zero-emission vehicles by 2030. This one's going to be more difficult, but the Department of Transportation thinks that we are on track. Although EO246 tackles the issue of climate change head-on, the state's attitude towards climate concerns was dramatically different only a decade ago. Powell says, in August of 2012, the North Carolina legislature, which was controlled by a governor, which was a Republican, and a supermajority of Republicans, passed a law that said the state was not allowed to consider science around sea level rise when establishing coastal policy. State government has grown in leaps and bounds since this stance of complete climate change denial, Powell says. In 2021, bipartisan law, House Bill 951, was passed to address climate change, and a budget was signed to increase the state's funding for storm resilience and other impacts of change. Collins says, while this is all positive progress, not much tangible action has taken place since EO 246 passing in January. Quote, I think that so far, all we've really done is get ourselves situated to really dig into the questions. Well, back to the original question. What's happened since January? Much of the progress that has occurred so far has centered around forming the committees that will eventually create climate action plans, says Kim Hunter, a lawyer at the Southern Environmental Law Center and an environmental representative on the Clean Transportation Plans Board. And she says, the Clean Transportation Plan Advisory Board has been set up, and those subcommittees have been set up, but there hasn't really been much progress made yet. We are still pretty early stages. Although the Clean Transportation Plan allowed the 15-month period of planning, Hunter says that that time frame should be looked at like a race, not a deadline. Quote, the governor's office said when they passed the executive order, that didn't mean they were going to wait 15 months before they actually did anything. But I haven't really seen any signs from DOT that there is any kind of imminent action plan. So I think it's going to take work to push forward and make sure that action happens in a more expedited time frame. Another EO 246 goal completed in last January was the updated greenhouse gas inventory, which showed that transportation emissions have overtaken energy generation emissions as the largest contributor of greenhouse gases in the state, says Powell. One of the biggest accomplishments to date was the recent appointment of an environmental justice lead in every agency. This required position isn't just about checking a box, but it prioritizes accountability and transparency with underserved communities, says Mary McLean Asbill, the director of the NC offices of the Southern Environment, the SELC. While all of the steps that have been taken since January are important, Maspel says there needs to be a push toward taking real action as soon as possible in order to reach the goals in EO246. Quote, I think it can be met by 2050, but the time is now. We can't plan to make a plan and have too many work sessions. They got to roll up their sleeves and get it done now. We don't have a minute to lose. Resettling Refugees is an article by Ryan Pulaski. More than 4 million refugees have fled Ukraine since February, dominating headlines around the world. Yet, closer to home, Afghans who fled during the U.S. withdrawal from that country 8 months ago are still arriving. And Triangle resettlement agencies are still helping evacuees build new lives. Adam Clark, director of World Relief Durham, says, I know that it seems like ancient history to the news cycles, but for us, it's daily life. While the initial wave of hundreds of arrivals has subsided, arrivals continue. Despite strong community support, local resettlement workers face obstacles at nearly every turn. Afghan refugees face unique legal challenges, as many are not guaranteed permanent legal status in the United States. Short-term housing, permanent housing, and language-appropriate mental health counseling also remain critical needs. Clark says, Ukraine, in many ways, is making it easy to forget what just happened a few months ago, but I think the community has not forgotten. When Kabul fell on August 15, 2021, professionals across the refugee resettlement community braced for an unprecedented surge in cases. More than 70,000 Afghans would flee the country for the United States in the months that followed. Omer, North Carolina Field Office Director for the U.S. Committee on Refugees, says, we knew this would be a situation that has never happened before in the United States in the resettlement of refugees. Usually it's very structured, well-organized, but this is completely out of plan. Resettlement organizations found themselves heavily unprepared and under-resourced for the influx of cases. The surge of refugees came on the heels of the Trump administration's lowering of the refugee ceiling. President Barack Obama's refugee ceiling for fiscal 2017 was 110,000. Trump set the ceiling for fiscal year 2021 at 15,000. And last year, the United States accepted just 11,400 refugees. Then came the news in August and September that thousands of Afghans were headed to the United States, including North Carolina. And Clark says, the biggest challenge was the short time frame. Most of the time, we know months ahead when a new population is going to come. In some cases, we had 24 to 48 hours from notification to arrival of a new family to serve. Omer's USCRI North Carolina field office first proposed it could take 100 refugees following the fall of Kabul. In the 2 months that followed, they received over 260. 7 months after Afghans first began arriving in the Triangle, volunteer response remains strong, yet substantial challenges remain. Omer said that when refugees first arrive, resettlement organizations look to be as welcoming as possible. You want to ensure that they receive a culturally appropriate meal when they arrive. The next focus becomes short-term housing, followed by permanent housing. Clark said Durham volunteers have helped with both, saying the level of community support has been tremendous. People offer their homes, their land, their cars. Volunteers have furnished apartments for incoming families, buying furniture, decorations, appliances, and more. Nancy Cook, who prepares homes for Church World Service, says, "We want to make the house just as perfect as we can." Even so, long-term housing remains out of reach for many Afghan families. USCRI still houses about 25% of its refugees in hotels because permanent housing has not been available. Clark says, "Being in the midst of an affordable housing crisis in our region and suddenly having such a large number of people to welcome is a challenge." These evacuees also face daunting legal challenges as they attempt to secure their future in the United States. The U.S. granted the vast majority of recent Afghan arrivals humanitarian parole status, which allows Afghan individuals, quote, who may be inadmissible or otherwise ineligible for admission into the U.S., to be in the United States for a temporary period for urgent humanitarian reasons or significant public benefit, according to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service. Many of these parolees have a pathway to stay in the U.S. lawfully through having American citizen family members or access to special immigrant visas, which can grant permanent resident to evacuees who aided the United States abroad. More than 36,000 Afghans, however, lack these routes. Their only option for remaining in the country legally is to file for asylum by proving that they meet the definition of a refugee. Until then, legally, they are considered evacuees. Shane Ellison, supervising attorney at Duke Law School's Immigrant Rights Clinic, says, "I think many, many, many evacuees will meet the definition of a refugee, but it's a really long and difficult process to apply for asylum in the United States. If those applications are not granted, then that 36,000 are at the mercy of Congress and the executive branch." Mental health care is another vital concern for local agencies. Afghan evacuees struggle to look ahead when their journeys to the United States come so quickly after encountering extreme trauma and violence. Clark says these families are coming fresh with traumatic experiences. Even in normal cases, where families spend years in the transition process, roughly 40% of refugees are diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. Clark says, refugees may have been in a camp for years or even decades, and it takes quite a long time to get to us. In this case, it was very unique to have folks coming, being able to talk about fleeing from the Taliban just a couple of weeks ago. The trauma branches from a variety of evacuee experiences, said Ahmad, a local Afghan resettlement worker who asked that his surname not be disclosed for the sake of his family's safety. They left their loved ones in Afghanistan, the house that they struggled for. They left all these things just in a matter of 2 weeks. They have lived in camps, sometimes for months. There is lack of information about life in the U.S. in the United States, so the expectation and the reality are two totally different things. After months of settling families, local volunteer Marion Abernathy still sees refugees struggling with their trauma, saying, "Most of the volunteers do not have the background or skills to provide that kind of trauma counseling or care. I think that's a big need, particularly for providers who are speaking Dari and Pashto." A co-chair, Abernathy is a co-chair of the Social Action Committee at Durham's Judea Reform Congregation. Establishing employment and routines can help refugees feel a part of American society, say refugee resettlement workers. With this, also, they say the community has offered essential support. Omer says employment is not an issue. A long time ago, it was. Looking ahead, Ahmad says he hopes local residents will remember what Afghan refugees have endured as they continue to adjust to life in North Carolina. Quote, if you see an Afghan with a different outfit or a different mindset, or if you see an Afghan who cannot speak your language, I would say, please be patient with them, and please help them to the extent you can, because they need time to become part of the community. Okay, folks, before reading the portion of my last article available, I'd like to enlist your help and advice. The Indie Week cultural calendar, which is beginning to take up life again after COVID, is an important resource for all sorts of events in and around the Triangle. Indie Week offers notices daily of one-day events through longer spans of time. This particular podcast, the one I do, is available all week, and it begins on being available on Fridays. To read everything available in the Indie calendar would take 15 or 20 minutes to do, and many events will have expired by the time some of you listeners click on this program. So, for this week, I will try out a system of reading only events that occur on 3 or more days. Now, this means that musical events and one-day presentations will be missing, but I've never had a chance to read many of them anyhow. You could always visit their website, indieweek.com, to zero in on this cultural calendar. But what I would appreciate now is your input to me about how, or even whether, you want these cultural events on this Indie Week podcast. There's always room for more articles when they are available. There's two ways to let me know your opinion on this. You could phone 919-832-5138, leave a brief message. Better, you can email info@ncreadingservice.org. Now, in either of these, phone or email, just refer to Indie Week in the subject line. So having said that, here we go. Some music articles, events for $50. Sylvan Esso production at historic Durham Athletic Park in Durham. It's a musical presentation from May 19th through the 21st. The North Carolina Symphony plays a classical concert May 2021 down at Duke Energy Center for the Performing Arts in Raleigh. Everything else on the musical calendar is one time. Let's look at stage. We have Emma, which is runs through May at various times at Peace University, P-E-S-E-E University in Raleigh, at various Leggett Theater at various times. Another show, the Walltown Children's Theater in Durham, Peerless. That's May 13th through 29th. Hamilton is appearing at DPAC in Durham through June 5. The Carolina Ballet is presenting Giselle, a classical ballet, down at Performing Arts Center in downtown Raleigh. J.P. Sears, available through May 21st at Goodnight's Factory and Restaurant. Then we have in art, a guided tour, May 19th through 20th. That's at the Ackland Art Museum in Chapel Hill, Modern Black Culture, the Art of Aaron Douglas, and art by John Whidden at Hillsborough Visitor Center in Hillsborough through September 8th. And the rest of the articles that I have gotten are all these one-day articles. So please, if you have a comment about whether any of this is useful to you or not, please get in touch with our phone or email address and be sure to reference Indie Week in that. Appreciated. And I won't have time to read this entire article, but it's in fact about the greatest show on dirt, Sylvan Esso, which is appearing May 19th through Saturday, May 21st. $50 charge at Durham Athletic Park in Durham. Nick McGregor writes this article about the music. Sylvan Esso's recent achievements are the stuff of most bands' fantasies. Strutting their red carpet stuff as presenters and nominees at the Grammy Awards, gracing both late night and daytime TV with appearances on Jimmy Kimmel and Ellen DeGeneres, taping a debut for long-running concert series Austin City Limits, and launching an independent label, Psychic Hotline, and an in-demand recording studio, Betty's. Yet bandmates Amelia Meath and Nick Sanborn say their biggest dreams will come true this weekend during a three-night stand at the historic Durham Athletic Park. Dubbed the greatest show on dirt, the downtown extravaganza includes all-star support acts opening for Sylvan Esso, after parties at three different venues, a Psychic Hotline pop-up shop at PS37, and exclusive baseball-themed merchandise from Oxford Pennant. It's a decade in the making, Seaboard and Meath tell Indie Week over homemade cold brew on the back porch of Betty's. Sanborn says, we headlined Hopscotch in 2016, but obviously that's Raleigh. Then we did our night at Shakori Hills, but that's way out there in Pittsburgh. Then we did two nights in DPAC in 2019, which was great, but it didn't feel like our usual thing. Everything was almost the thing, but this feels like a culmination, like a true hometown show we've been trying to play at the ballpark for years. Years, Meath emphasizes. I mean, James Brown played there. I would like to go on the record and say that I've always wanted to do our thing downtown. It seems like a really wonderful way to connect back to Durham. And I have to cut way to the end of this article to illustrate who the people will be that open for Sylvan Esso, and that's Little Brother and Yola Tengo. And let's see, Indigo D'Souza and Mr. Twin Sister. And that's all that I have a chance to read from this article. But again, that's a $50 charge for the Durham Athletic Park over the weekend for Sylvan Esso, the greatest show on dirt. And Balthazar and Ethel, our own musicians, bring this broadcast or this podcast of Indie Week to a close with me, John Fetterson, going to gargle because I've been reading a long time today. And we hope you'll listen to future podcasts on ncreadingservice.org. And this is John Fetterson again for Indie Week, and I'll be on podcast for our next issue. So long, folks.